The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. I'm delighted to be joined today by Jennifer McKenna. We'll be talking about making work a healthy and joyful experience so that it doesn't take a toll on your health and happiness. Jennifer is founder and CEO of JMAC Consulting. She is passionate about building the strongest, healthiest cultures possible. Jennifer has devoted the past 17 years to helping leaders consciously develop their leadership skills, create a strong vision, face enormous challenges, and harness their impact to make a positive change in their companies and communities. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, we spend so much of our time at work, and how our day goes at work has such an important effect on our health, our family, the people around us. When you work with the many groups you work with, you know, whether it's teams or individuals, how can you help people identify, or how does a person know, are they in a good environment, or is this the best fit for me? Should I be doing something differently? What are the kinds of questions that a person should start asking?
So I love that you've asked this, because I think that we quantitatively spend more hours in our jobs than anything else we do, including sleep. So it has a massive impact, whether negative or positive, on our lives and the quality of our lives. So, you know, a lot of times when I start working with someone, it is either their peer or their loved one who will secretly come to me and say, thank you so much. Because others are noticing over time change in behavior, change in sleep pattern, change in mood, change in hours, right? You went from working, maybe you were supposed to work 40 hours and your norm was 50 to 60 and now you're working 70, right? Maybe you started giving yourself permission to miss your child's ball game once and now it's become the norm. Maybe you get to the end of your day and you're so tired that you kind of just want to eat the grab and go and don't want to deal with a meal, much less conversation, meaningful conversation with other adults. And this is particularly harmful if those are family members. Not to pick on singles, because you also have lives out there that, you know, you may not be coming home to a spouse, but you have loved ones and you have peers and you have associates and acquaintances and people who love you, who are noticing changes in you. So if you are ignoring those changes, then one of the questions you can ask yourself is, are other people treating me differently? How would I be perceived if I just stopped what I was doing right now and I looked at the last week of my life and how I spent that time? What can I say about that? Was I energized when I woke up in the morning, or did I wake up exhausted? Was I so tired I didn't even want to brush my teeth before I went to bed? These are silly questions, but they're extremely telling in how much of your life you've given to your job, and it will catch up to you. If it's just a small sign or symptom today where your relationships aren't being as meaningful, you're not engaging in the conversation anymore like you used to, you're not really listening because you're on your phone checking your email, those little things become big things. They break up whole relationships. They tear down whole bodies. Those little things do massive damage over time if left ignored.
Yeah, no, definitely, because being in healthcare, we certainly see the effect of stress, and it's so common. A lot of people that I, you know, work with, I'm sure it's the same for you, feel that they don't have the balance that they would like between, you know, coming home with enough energy to do something other than work, yet find it hard to know what to do to break out of that situation, because they may have a boss that expects certain things done by a certain time. The volume of work may be unrealistic. They're maybe, you know, short-staffed, et cetera. I mean, a lot of people are in these situations where they're not even seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, but they're not sure how to restore that balance, even when they see, you know, changes they don't like in themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for, well, what do you do when you're just not happy, you don't like that environment that you're in?
Yeah. The single most important thing you can ask yourself in that situation is, do I value myself more than my job? It really becomes that simple, because all of the justifications you're making for it, be it, you know, my boss expects this, my team expects this, my customers expect this, whoever's expecting this, okay, fair enough. Those are true, legitimate observations. But if you value yourself more than your job, then you will start pushing back in effective ways. It doesn't mean you have to cause conflicts or stir up waves that are so big it could take you down. What's going to take you down is this accommodating mentality. That's what's going to take you down. And I think that we fear disappointing others more than we value the quality of our lives. And so the conundrum becomes this frustration of, I just feel trapped, when really you're not trapped. Your brain is trapping you by believing that.
Now that is so interesting, you know, of there's certainly external pressure, but how much of it is self-imposed, right? Yeah. The expectations we have and how much maybe we're imposing those on the people we report to or our colleagues. When you're trying to get an honest assessment of yourself, you know, to become more self-aware, to know, okay, how much is my personality? How much can I say is the environment, and how much really it's me?
Yeah.
What are good ways to raise that self-awareness?
Well, so in the workplace, I do personality assessments as a very baseline starting point. And it's very basic, very simple, and there are free tools out there. But little tools like that can start that self-awareness process. When you really start to understand how you make decisions, how you like your environment, how you perceive things or take in information, where you get your energy, how you handle stress. There are assessments that show you all these things in the most base form. Now, we're not all, you know, robots, though sometimes the brain functions like that. So this is just a starting point, right? We're all a lot more unique than what I'm suggesting, but it's a great starting point to really, to understand yourself is to honor yourself. And it basic information like that validates you as a person to say, wait, I don't need to prove my worth by accommodating this other person. I need to understand myself better so that I can meet my needs and communicate in a way that helps meet the requests of others, the needs of others, right? I think another thing to increase self-awareness is asking the simple question, am I taking ownership of more than what's mine?
Yeah, I think a lot of people can identify with that.
Right. Because we, you know, there's something inside many of us that we're just driven to be helpful, to want to be helpful, right? We're just driven to want to connect with other people. And when we see someone in need or someone who we want to support, it can be like a drug, right? It can be where we misplace our own worth in helping the other person if it gets so out of balance that we neglect our own needs.
Yeah, so if a person goes through a personality assessment and they find that they are that person, the one that takes the ownership, hates to say no, hates to disappoint, you know, a lot of the responses and the ways we interact with others are really unconscious. So how do we then catch ourselves, identify, you know, when we've said yes and realize that maybe we shouldn't have, or get to this kind of unconscious level of how we operate?
So that's a really extraordinary question, because I literally started the business off of a methodology that I created, it was 17 years ago. Yeah, almost exactly. And I created it because I was diagnosed with a chronic illness as a result of workaholism. I was masterful at accommodating others. I was masterful at neglecting my own needs to the point of my demise. So I speak not just from professional experience, but I speak from personal experience. And I had a number of people come to me and say, I saw the transformation you made in your personal life, but I also saw how you led in the workplace. So I'd like for you to coach me. And this was at the advent of the coaching industry. And I was so humbled by that. And I thought, well, how would I teach someone what I have learned about myself that caused that transformative experience? And that's how I created the methodology, because I thought, well, if I'm going to coach somebody, I have to have tools to demonstrate and to guide. And I can't just say, you need to do this. You know, that's no good, not worth anything. And so my methodology is literally focused on unconscious beliefs and behaviors, how they are triggered, how they are so deeply wired inside of us that our brain is activated without our knowledge. We get what's called triggered, right? We all know that word now. And that sends us into kind of an autopilot response. And so next thing we know, we're hurting ourselves without even knowing it, because we just thought we were helping others, as an example. And so there is a really truly unconscious piece to it. So when you use that word, I think it's way more meaningful than probably what you intended in the question. It is my job as a coach, when I work with people, to bring that to the conscious mind so that people can take ownership. So what I look for in my questions, in my initial assessment, are patterns of behavior, because the brain's operating on that and they're just responding in their behavior to that. And so those become self-sabotaging behaviors. And then over time, it almost functions like an addiction in the brain, where the brain just, it feeds off of it. And so then you've got the contradictory voices in your head, the ones that go with the pattern saying you have to do this, right? You can't step outside your comfort zone, because then your life is threatened. This is what the ego wants you to think, right? And then there's that other part that is conscious that's saying, then why am I sad? Why am I exhausted? Why? And that creates the inner conflict. So I think it's incredibly important to first to just ask yourself base questions of inner conflict. Am I struggling with that situation? Do I have these contradictory voices in my head and that are causing me to just not know what to do, to not know what's right, to not know where to go to change? And so then I just go back into my habit.
Sure. And if there is that internal conflict, but you know that maybe you're not always happy, how do you, you work one-on-one with people. Do you recommend people seek out a coach, seek out someone who's objective and can work with them through this?
I do. I have had coaches over the years. Even though I coach hundreds of people, I'm human. I can't see my blind spots. We're all human. We're all subject to our brains, and our brains aren't always operating in our best interest. So my analogy for everyone is, it's time to upgrade your operating system, right? Your brain is a computer. It's got, it's the hardware, and then it's got all these applications. And just like our computers, they get outdated, and you've got to upgrade them. And there's work there to do. And it's very difficult to do that on your own, because you don't see your blind spots, and you can't create consciousness if it's deeply buried inside of you, right? You can do a lot of spiritual practices that will help settle the mind. And meditation is a phenomenal way of allowing the right voices, the healthy voices, the higher purpose voices to rise to the occasion and speak to you. And I think that's hugely important. But even if you are disciplined enough to do that and you are able to get your own self-guidance, that doesn't necessarily mean you know what to do with it, right? And so I do think that, you know, the point of what I'm saying is not to say everybody should be coach or counselor dependent. Not at all. What I'm saying is I think it is the human spirit's way of forcing us to come together, that we need human interaction and we all need to be empathetic and we all need to build relationship. And those are hugely important. So I think that the coach or counselor is a great way to start until you increase that self-awareness and have your toolkit, because the habit of going to your best friend or your boyfriend or your spouse or your mother, well, they're biased. And that could cause more conflict than help in the beginning until you have more sure footing on the ground of who you are and what you want. And then those relationships become more meaningful.
Right. No, that's really good advice. I think it's so hard, as you said, to see those blind spots and be objective when you don't have any comparison, you know, when it's your own mind and you've lived in your own mind and your own thoughts. Yes. I want to switch gears a little. You know, we're talking about being in environments that may not always be conducive, but I want to flip it over to how do we create or know that we're in a positive environment? How do we get so much out of work where work fuels us, adds to our life, adds to our health, makes us excited that we're on a path of doing something meaningful? How do we get on that positive spiral?
So I think there are multiple routes to that, but the first question goes back to the original one of, do I value myself? Because if I value myself, I'm going to be brave and bold enough to take those next steps. Because it may be that once you assess what you really need to be healthy and happy and whole, has nothing to do with your job, right? And then when you go to designate time to what it does require, you will naturally start setting boundaries at the office, because you are suddenly finding something in your life that is more important. So having a vision for yourself is a critical first step. It is so critical, because at the base of all of our thought processes is a choice between fear and love, and that's very primal. And we don't even know that's what we're doing. It's part of the unconscious element. But the joy and the purpose and the meaning and, you know, just all the good things, right? Come from that space of love, but at the core of it, it's self-love, and you have to value yourself to love yourself. So otherwise, we will fall to the polar opposite inside of ourselves, which is the fear, and that's when the job wins out. Well, I'm afraid I'm going to get fired if I prioritize that. Okay, well, then you don't have a vision, because if you had a vision that stirred your soul, you would let that be more important, and you would start naturally setting boundaries.
From your experience with working with people, would you say majority of people operate out of love and vision or out of fear?
Fear.
Yeah, and I thought you would say that.
Definitely. And that may be a biased response because of the nature of my work, right? People aren't calling me if their life is just flowing and wonderful and they have no issues. So if you're operating from a place of love 24/7, you don't need me for sure. And stay what you're doing. Just keep at it. I think though that culturally we have perpetuated that. And I think that's, you know, that's the chicken or the egg, right? It's how many individuals do we have to create the culture? And then when did the culture become so big that it started feeding back to perpetuate the problem? And so if you look around right now, we are absolutely in the throes of a fear-based culture, and it's coming at us hard every day through every medium out there. And so we are inundated with negativity, and that perpetuates the problem that we have inside of ourselves.
Yeah. And finding your personal vision, you know, you make it sound easy, but I know, having tried it myself, it's incredibly difficult because so much of life, you're told what you do. You respond and react. Like, you finish your inbox, you then respond to the text, go to a meeting. Your day is structured so that you're responding. But when you're put in the position of, gee, if it were entirely up to me, what would I do?
Yes.
It's really hard to answer that.
It's very hard. So yeah, I love that you called me out on that, because I do have a tendency. And I think a lot of it is because I really love what I do and I get passionate about it. So I go into every room, no matter how intense it is, with a huge smile on my face. And a tremendous amount of empathy and compassion in my heart, because I know firsthand how hard it is. It is excruciatingly hard to change. It is hard on the brain. It is hard on the system. It is hard on our hearts. It's hard. It just is. And so that's why I have the tagline, we make change fun and productive, because change is not fun and productive. I mean, well, it's usually productive, but oftentimes it comes in reaction to our lack of proactivity, right? We're not making the healthy choices. Therefore, change is forced upon us ultimately with the bad diagnoses or the divorce or whatever it is. And so, so you're right. I do make it sound joyful, and it is joyful when you get into the conversation, right? But it's terrifying when you're sitting on the outset and you really are pointing at yourself and you're really empowering yourself and you're saying, what do you really want? That right there is the hardest question any of my clients ever have to answer.
And what advice do you give them to coach them through that process?
So I'll ask them all kinds of questions, but you know, for starters, I like to find out, okay, if you tell me what you don't want, right? Let's start where you are. I have a big, big belief that we have to meet people where they are and then help them get where they want to go. So instead of forcing the issue, if they don't come to me with this huge vision and help, you know, the question, help me get there, right? Then it becomes, so tell me why you are here. And then what ensues is a conversation around all the frustrations, all the issues, you know, the vicious cycle. And that's where I can start to identify what's important to them that they may not know, because they just feel so overwhelmed, right? Sure. So I can identify through that conversation what's important to them, what's a pattern in what I'm hearing, what are the fears getting in the way of it, and then I can gently show that back to them, and from that space, we can decide, is there an aspect of your life you want to focus on in your vision, or is it your overall life you want to tackle, right? So for me, at my lowest point in my life, which wasn't even the 20-year-ago chronic health diagnosis, it was I had already been launched this business. I was, I don't know how many years into it, maybe 7, 8. I don't know, but I went through a divorce. I got breast cancer.
Oh goodness.
My dad was in and out of the hospital 4 states away, threatening to die every other day. My daughter had chronic food allergy issues. And I was self-employed. And I left my entire material world in my divorce intentionally, and which is insane. I don't know why somebody didn't commit me right then, because I was literally operating from a space where I had hit an overwhelm button accidentally, because I had taken on everything. I just thought I could, you know, I had proven to myself what I could handle. I had overcome this other thing. I can do anything, right? I felt invincible. And so, you know, that was the invitation to the wrecking ball to come and just, you know, bring me to my knees to gain some reality. But the beauty of that was I got real clear on my vision, because when I was down to nothing, I said to myself, okay, I now know what it feels like to be my weakest. I want to know what it feels like to be my strongest. And that became my vision. I wanted to be in physical shape. I wanted to start eating healthier. I wanted to do all these things because I had never consciously done any of it. You know, I ate well. After the first diagnosis, I really shaped up my lifestyle dramatically from where I had been before. But I realized I still wasn't at a space of intentionally creating the life I really wanted. And so, you know, I went from, I mean, this was years ago, where I was a chronic smoker and drinker. I mean, I was a workaholic. And so what did I do when I came home from, you know, the 14-hour day? I would have a cigarette and a cold beer. Who knows what? I was just as happy as can be. You know, I grew up in the Midwest. We have a hard work ethic. I have Irish blood flowing through my veins. And I was really happy with the work hard, play hard lifestyle until it caught up to me. And so when I had the vision of what would it be like, I've never asked myself that question. What would my strongest self feel like? And today I'm addicted to going to the gym. Wow. Yeah. You know, I just love it. And I love feeling healthy and I love the vitality. I turned 50 this year and I feel healthier than I have felt in any younger age of my life.
You know, and I'm so glad you mentioned that, because being in the sphere of healthcare, you know, we're pretty good at looking at objective markers, right? So we can go through someone's diet, tear it apart, and objectively say, okay, you need X number or grams of this, et cetera. How many times a week are you exercising? How many minutes? These are objective, like, do you smoke? Do you not smoke, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What you're touching on is the spiritual, the emotional, which I think is such a huge part of health. It's a huge part of our life, and how important this is in every aspect of how we feel, how we interact, how we lead, mm-hmm. you know, what we get out of life. When you went through this transformative process, along the way, you know, there's always improvement. How did you keep self-assessing to say, okay, can I get even to a better place and a better place versus saying, hey, look how far I've come. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always hard to know where you are in that continuum.
I think that when you make a decision to strengthen your spirit, you touch on the spiritual and emotional piece. I think when you make a decision to do that, it's a game changer. It's a game changer, because there's the only thing, in my opinion, that is more powerful than the human brain is the human spirit. And we see it in all the movies and the stories and all the great, you know, tales of history, from the true stories, right? The true stories are the ones that are most unbelievable, because we have testimony after testimony about the strength of the human spirit when the situation is beyond mental or physical capacity. And when you make that decision and you empower your spirit, this gentle, delicate, but extraordinary piece of yourself, then you take on practices, you know, you, whether it's meditation or more nature walks, just connecting, you know, with a higher power, whatever that may be. And that's not religious, but it can be, right? This transcends religion. Religion is just a practice of faith, but faith is an action. Faith is something, it's a skill inside of you that's dying to be honed. And it needs spiritual practice for that. And so, you know, when we do that, I think we are boundless. I think that the questions more readily find answers. I think the confusion starts to really dissipate. I think the mind, when the spirit says, listen, brain, I have been at your mercy for years. And the body, you know, this body is feeling the same way I am. We've both been quite beaten up by you. So what we'd like for you to do is be our servant instead of our slave master. Big difference. The brain holds us hostage. It does enslave us. And we, if we don't take charge of that, if we do not make a decision to be smarter than our brains, we will forever be at the mercy of them.
Yeah, no, that is really powerful advice. I think That's such a good way to frame how to approach where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's great. Jennifer, you know, this has just been so insightful. It's just been so wonderful talking to you. And thank you for all the work you do and the difference you make in so many people's lives. Are there any final thoughts you want to share with our audience?
Well, I want to thank you for the work that you do. And I'm delighted to be here. And I'm very humbled that you've invited me onto the show to share this. And I do hope that you continue to make an impact in your world, because I think that much of the culture and much of our population is still in a frame of mind where I just want to go to the doctor and fix things. And while that's a really important and meaningful first step, I do hope that when that's happening, that everyone takes a moment to realize that if you need to fix something, then there's something greater to address than just that issue. So those would be my parting words.
Oh, gosh, yeah, I would echo that. I think there's a lot of wisdom to looking at health in a really broader spectrum, just as you coach people to look at their role in their workplace and in how they interact with others in a more broader, more global sense. So that's just great advice. So thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.